Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the SFIA monthly livestream Q&A. We'll get started in just a moment, but go ahead and start getting your questions in the chat window so our moderators can start relaying those to me as soon as we start. Please try to keep the questions concise and watch your spelling, and try to be polite to others in the chat. We usually go for about an hour, so you probably want to grab a drink and a snack, though we'll take a break about halfway through, too. With all that said, welcome, and let's get started. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our show. We're just going to double check real quick that all of our audio and visual is working correctly for a change, since we had that fun glitch at the beginning of last month's episode with no audio for 2 minutes. And go ahead and start getting your questions in now while we have a chance to detect that. And if anyone who's in the chat can go ahead and confirm that they can hear me, that would be appreciated. So what's our first question from last month while waiting for those to come in?
Yeah, Albert Jackinson had asked if gravitons do in fact exist and we learn to create them and or harness their properties, what technology applications would they have?
The key thing about gravitons is a lot like neutron beams. They're one of those things where if you can find a material that actually reflects gravitons or lets you twist which direction they're going, so they're not just omnidirectionally emitting, that's what lets you do a lot of things like anti-gravity or maybe create a singularity at a particular spot you wanted or do some of the warp drive stuff that people tend to like to think about doing. That's the big thing you do if you have artificial graviton creation. That's one of the two types of grazor, as opposed to a laser or a mazor. There was a gravity laser, which is a grazor, and there was a gamma ray laser, and they're both completely different, but also both suffer from the thing that can't be made because we have nothing that's reflected to those materials. Either one would be awesome to have, though.
So we had another question on how you think convergent evolution would affect life from different biospheres.
It kind of depends on if we mean convergent evolution socially or in a more biological sense. We would have very little reason to think that random mutation would take us back to a particular modal, but you'd expect, like, we think eyeballs have evolved multiple times, for instance. Socially, though, I think what people mean by convergent evolution in most cases is not like a biologically same body, but more of a socially same unit. And in that case, we can look at examples from our own civilization, you know, in places where they've kind of come back to the same idea. There's only so many ways you can build a road. And in some ways, you have a better chance of getting convergence socially than biologically, because anything that's based off logic and kind of take you to the same location eventually is the idea. But it's still a bit of a long shot to assume a culture will come up the same thing. They probably make screws the same as we make screws. They'd probably make an axe or a wedge the same. Their automobile might have 4 tiles. But at the same time, there's going to be so many differences that those similarities will be minuscule, probably.
Well, I see the questions are rolling in. So kicking off today, we have a question from about technological singularity with Animal Gupta. Is it necessary that warp drive need only exotic matter?
It so much depends on how you define exotic matter. The thing is, all of the matter we know of right now causes gravity and space-time to condense when you're doing things with it, in which case it is warping space-time, but not in the way we want. To do any kind of warp drive relies on expanding space in front of you, contracting in front of you, expanding behind you, which means you need some sort of matter that will expand space rather than contract it. We don't know of any such type of matter, so anything that would do that would be exotic by definition, but there's a lot of different hypothetical exotic matters that could do the trick. We don't know of any of them, though.
I was just laughing. I saw a super chat from Eric Johansson saying, finally, I didn't miss the live stream.
Welcome, Eric.
We're going to have to wait for his question, though, because I have a few more in front of him. Tio Tom Taz Tur, what are your opinions on the world building to sleep in the sea of stars? Sleep in a sea of stars.
What's my opinion? The world building, is it a story?
What are your opinions on the world building of to sleep in a sea of stars? I think that is a story.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't know that story. If you want to leave that one in the comments, I can check and see if it's one I've heard of otherwise, but I don't know, and I'm afraid.
All right, question from Paul Shields. Will you comment on the recently released governor reports on UAPs?
I think Simon had a comment about that, too. Let's see. No. We did an episode last year on the Navy UFOs, and it is something we should probably get to. Joe Scott, he did a good initial video on that, too, discussing that a little bit. We will do one, but I haven't had a chance to really dip it in deep detail, and I think everyone knows the channel knows that I'm obviously on the skeptical side, but I'm not gonna just go in and say, oh, it's all nonsense, or oh, this is, you know, changing my mind until I've had a chance to really dive into it. And that usually means I see other people's analysis on a lot of the aerial stuff, because I'm not an aerospace engineer, so I can miss little stuff, you know, that somebody else can buy and say that's obvious. And I really am kind of waiting to hear other people's thoughts on it and have a chance to really structure mine before we do another video on that. But when what's there, we'll probably do one.
Johnny Wing says, so Isaac, I know you're a big fan of fusion, but do you think it would be possible for us to figure out antimatter and a leap past fusion as a main energy production method?
The problem with creating antimatter, ignoring all the storage issues, is that it would probably be very hard to ever create antimatter in an energy positive way, which makes a great battery storage. If you can do it like even 2-to-1, that's great for fuel. You can make it some big facility, store it up and use it. But what's more likely is that it would be a very high energy production thing of, well, maybe even 100-to-1 might be possible, and that would be amazing. In which case, something like antimatter catalyzed fusion, which would use a little tiny amount of antimatter to set off a whole bunch of fusion reactions, in a much tinier bomb, you know, it's a little pellet size thing, that becomes your energy producing drive method that's very good and fusionish. If you can produce antimatter cheap enough, obviously, even if you can't produce it at a profit, that's still a great spaceship fuel. But, you know, I think a black hole drive, for instance, has some advantages even then, because you can't produce the antimatter for free on the way, but you can suck matter in with a black hole and shoot out. So there's ups and downs of all these ways drives you can work in, but antimatter's your best fuel if you can make it cheaply and store it safely. So that would be better than fusion.
Speaking of Albert Jackinson, he's back, and he says, good afternoon, Isaac. I had a medical incident last week, and that got me to thinking about the medical field, as you might expect. What medical technology do you expect to see emerging in the next century?
Well, hi, Albert, and welcome back. Probably one of the most prolific question askers down the years. I hope you're feeling better. What was the question again? I just completely lost track of it.
What medical technology do you expect to see emerging in the next century?
In the next century? A lot of them. I mean, you got to think about how much we've had to develop in the last century. Your pacemakers, all your cancer treatments, virtually every cure we have is either modern polished in the last century or completely invented in the last century. Medical nanotechnology, the big one, the ability to genetically engineer things that can do a lot of fixing up or virus killing, retroviruses. Almost everything we discussed in that biotech episode, to be honest, from about 2 months ago. I would go down to that one, and the post-human video we did right before that really talks about a lot of those options, and I hope you're feeling better about it.
Eric Herzl, since no solution to the Fermi paradox is sufficient, what do you think of, quote, all the solutions you've covered adding up to another great filter?
I mean, not all of them in the sense of some of them are contradictory, of course. Or would be physically impossible. But the usual idea for the great filters is that you might luck out with one that's like the billion and one odds, but it's more likely that it would be one of those things that adds up a lot. I would tend to say you're going to have some of them that are the big ones, the one in a million odds, but you're just going to have this stack of, even those will be probably something you could divide into subcategories that have better odds each, but you're going to have the stack of small improbabilities are just going to stack up to make it virtually impossible, is my guess. That is a good point, though. We don't actually have any good answers to the Fermi paradox. We have least bad ones. Even the ones I favor are the least bad. You know?
LessRex123 wants to know, what's your education? It's good to know they can count.
Wait, it's good to know who can count.
Well, they have 1, 2, 3 in their title, so they want to know what your education is.
Sarah and I are actually both homeschooled. By the way, I want to introduce my wife. She is the lovely assistant reading us questions this week. I guess I got my GD back in 1996 when I was 16, and I started college at Kent, local school first, to keep me home. Then I finished my bachelor's there and stuck around for grad school. I did a little over 2 years of grad school, about 60-some credit hours, so past the master's level, but not into thesis zone, and left for the Army. When I came back, I had zero desire to ever go back to it, though. But I'd say 90% of what I've learned in life has been just out of books, films, TV, you know, educational things, audiobooks. That is the best education you can always get, but I would say for things like physics and math, it is very handy to actually have access to professors to help you stick you on the right path, too. So, but that's the background education there.
Isaac Bordeaux also wants to know what your thoughts are on string theory. Welcome back, Isaac.
You know, we were just writing an episode on, what was it I was writing this on? String theory came up, and this would be one of the episodes like September, October, because that's where we're at right now. The Edge of the Universe for August 26th, episode 305, where we brought up kind of the concept of string theory. And the thing is, I like string theory as a concept. It is probably one of our best models, but I have also tend to often come off on it very negative because while it's the best model I know of, I do feel like way too often theorists or popular media imply that this is some kind of almost proven or nearly so locked in thing like relativity. It is not. There is literally zero physical evidence for string theory, or M theory, or multiverses, or Copenhagen. There is no evidence. It's not like neutrinos, where it was hard to get evidence, we got a little bit. It's not like dark matter, where we have evidence all over the place, we just can't nail the individual bits down. We don't have any evidence to back them up. What we do have is superb mathematical models that fit it, and mostly. And that's often a good place to begin. That's how we found quarks, for instance, and neutrinos. But at the same time, my opinion of string theory is it's our best model, though I tilt to M theory, which is six of one, half dozen of the other. But I don't like to treat them as hard science yet. On the other hand, I'm not a pure Popperian. I don't think that you can say that string theory isn't science because it doesn't have any evidence. It's in that hazy zone of where you would be nice to have some physical evidence, but you can't just stop doing science because you can't get the ideal scientific, you know, theory approach to hypotheses there either.
Annabelle Cassas, what
I
would
get so much hate mail from cosmologists after that. Sorry.
Annabelle Cassas says, what would life be in a galactic empire, and can you make a video about it?
That was, I think, the Galactic Domination series that we're doing is kind of that. We did do a Interstellar Empires one, too, but the new Galactic Domination series is kind of trying to look at if this was the goal of that civilization, if this was the reason they were taking over a galaxy, what's the motivation? And we started with the big one there of, we have this empire just because we want an empire and we don't want anyone else to have it. And the one that comes up this upcoming week is going to be looking at, what if your big goal is just resource utilization? What if the reason you have an empire is you want to grab everything? Then we got the Galactic Laboratory coming up, which is, you know, what if your motivation is just science, right? That's the big push motive for your empire. And that is, when we try to look at galactic empires, because they're so hard to put together under known science, or even though ones that allow faster light travel, you have to know what is that big motivation that keeps everything together. And that's what we'll explore in that series.
Okay, I want to give a few shout-outs here to our Super Chats. You did mention Simon Farmer. He gave a Super Chat of $10, and he also had a similar question on the UAP Pentagon Report. And he says, thank you for building a great community. We also had a Super Chat, it looks like £10, from Samuel Dominguez Lorenzo. And he says, thanks for all the awesome content, Isaac. And Alaskan Ballistics, also a $10 Super Chat. If matter, and he has a question, if matter was closer together in space and closer in time to the Big Bang, would time have been slowed down compared to our normal time, being so much mass in one place?
Yes, but no. There's another thing we discussed in that Edge of the Universe episode we were discussing. That's kind of our hyperspace episode there, too, because we're getting back into the Faster and Light series. I think we're Cheating Reality coming up shortly as the first one of that. You could jump into a congruent universe and move through it and was small like that, pop back into a new one if you had some way of doing that, and expect to come out having traveled faster than light, relatively speaking. But just being inside a universe where everything's slowing down time-wise, but the nature of our assumption of how universes work right now, which again is something we'll get more in that episode, is that the whole thing is doing that. If everything slowed down, and then relative to what? There's nothing to compare it to because that's everything. So that's kind of the context for that. Time would be running slower, but no one's there to measure it, as it were.
Captain Frantic says, are you an A theory or a B theory of time?
I don't have any official time one. The arrow of time questions that come up, is it gravity? Is it dark energy is another popular one. I don't have one I subscribe to. I do not have even a mode for how we think of time that I subscribe to. I just work with Minkowski space for the purpose of relativity and leave the philosophizing up to those who are better suited to that, or myself when it so inclines me.
Also a question here from Joey. He says, if you could move back in time and move distance and then rapidly go back to the future, would you move vast distances across space without exceeding the speed of light?
Was that just a hyperspace question again? Can you read that one again? Sorry, I got distracted.
I think it is very similar to that question we had earlier, but it's from a different audience member, Joey. If you could go back in time and move a distance and then rapidly go back to the future, would you move vast distances across space without exceeding the speed of light?
Yeah, that is actually something we talked about that same video I was just mentioning. That is, the idea is not to go to your own universe. That's why I say congruent universes, because if you're going backward in time, the question then becomes, why are you going forward in time again? You know, why not just colonize that universe back then or something like that? So, but yeah, that's exactly what would happen if there was congruency that way. That's the question is, if I jump back in time 10 minutes here, am I landing here, or am I landing how much the Earth has spun in 10 minutes, or how much the Earth has orbited in 10 minutes, etc.
Okay, we have a Psycho X Team question. What do you think of Kessler syndrome being a possible solution to the Fermi paradox?
Doesn't work out as one. Kessler syndrome is the name for when a space debris event starts to spiral, and you get a whole bunch of debris scattered all over the place that makes more debris. You know, I have a piece of debris, it hits a satellite, that satellite explodes, sends out more debris, which hits other satellites, and next thing you know, you have a big cloud of matter all around the planet. And I think the first time I became familiar with that idea was actually from Palladium's Rifts game, as that was the reason for why the planet Earth was trapped off in space in the post-apocalyptic future, was there was Kessler syndrome all around that, keeping them from their space habitats on the moon. But the problem is, space debris doesn't last forever. It goes away. It can be cleared. It's very hard to do. We were talking about that a little bit yesterday at the International Space Development Conference that the NSS put on, for those of you who caught that. Space debris is problematic to remove, but it can be removed and it goes away on its own. So it really doesn't fit that constant problem situation that would fit it.
We have a few questions about upcoming episodes, or if you've done an episode recently on a topic. The first one is, do you plan on going back to Event Horizon again?
Anytime John invites me on, probably. Probably anytime John invites me
on. It sounds like they're thinking about it. Sindri says he's they're in the process of thinking about that. Vi Sci-Fi says, have you spoken on proposed global governments?
I've, like every other young person in my lifetime, ranted about any number of governmental systems down the years. We actually have an episode
called... We had an episode on it.
The Geopolitics of Space, coming up with What If Art Hist, the art history channel that Rudyard runs. He'll be looking more at the current governments potentially doing that than I will be. I'll be more setting the stage, but that episode will be coming out in July.
And Silver Comic says, hi, Isaac. What do you consider the greatest failure mode of futurists of the past?
I see what Henry Ford said, if you ask people what they want, they'd say, build me a faster horse. That's the one that we all get. You get stuck in the problem of the present. This happens to a lot of my colleagues who talk about space travel in general, is they are so naturally lashed on to trying to figure out how to get the lightest, you know, how to get space travel going with really light ships, they tend to forget about some of the changes, the problems that exist if you have cheap energy, for instance, and you can suddenly have, you know, a meter thick armor on something. We all get kind of stuck in those modes. That's not just a futurism thing, but that tends to be a faster horse.
Yeah, I think this one is one you've also done an episode on recently. Time Zone says, hi, Isaac. How do you think if a completely automated alien sleeper ship does a gravitational maneuver around our sun with no effort of communicating with humans, how do you think that people will react?
I'm sorry, one more time?
How do you think a completely automated alien sleeper ship, if they did a gravitational maneuver around our sun with no effort to communicate with humans, how do you think that people would react?
Could we see a Muamua? Oh, I always mispronounce that. Frazier Kane from University Today once walked me through how to actually pronounce that, and I still can't get it right. but we had that one exostellar asteroid that came through that was shaped like a seagull. And the question was whether that was a sleeper ship or not. And I said, wow, we lucked out and saw one. Exactly, we did luck out and see that. Once we saw it, we cannot keep track of it, though. That would be kind of your odds on seeing a sleeper ship based on its size, except that they really shouldn't have a slingshot this close to the sun. We probably have millions of those passed through the solar system in a given, century. So,
and you had an episode on that, correct?
Hmm?
You had an episode on sleeper ships.
Yeah, we did have an episode on sleeper ships, yeah. That's more of the idea of us building them and the problems with them, though. But yes, very undetectable, relatively speaking.
Question from back down on the boat. What kind of governance do you think SpaceX will create in their upcoming Mars colony? And the side commentary is that Eli won't answer my tweets. So.
I think it would be a really bad idea for anyone that... You don't casually start up your own new government. It takes a long time. And here's the thing. If you suddenly declare yourself a country of 10,000 people... I live in a tiny rural suburb of a tiny city of 20,000 people in a relatively unpopulated county of 100,000 in a state of 10 million. And I don't think Ohio, even as one of the biggest states out there, could really push around like the U.S. or China or things like that to say, hey, we're independent, let alone could the little village I live in. You need probably to have a population of hundreds of thousands before you could ever achieve political independence or your own governmental system in modern context, because you have to offer services to people. And who's running your courts? How many judges do you have with a colony of 1,000 people? How many doctors do you have? And are they all specialists? And what do you do if all the other countries say, hey, we're angry at you now, we're embargoing you, so you're on your own, we're not going to shoot you, we're just going to tell you you're all on your own? That's a problematic situation to be in unless you've got a really big population.
Especially in outer space.
Yeah, where everything is hostile and designed to kill you.
Denver Sanchi says, what do you think the most likely form of faster than light is? I believe that's what he means. He put FTL.
Yeah, that is it. Well, the most likely to me is none at all. I really don't think we'll ever get that. But if I had to guess, I would say probably the hyperspace portions of it, where you could, if there are parallel realities that you can move between, that would be the one you would be able to probably most likely do, is a congruent shift. But I don't tend to think any of them are very probable to be something we could do. Ever.
Okay, on that lovely note, Lucas Spren wants to know if you have read The Fundamentals of Astrodynamics and whether or not you would recommend it.
Looking over the shelf to see if anyone will title that without me knowing it. No, I don't have that particular book. I'm trying to see what the actual name of the astrophysics books I have. I had astrophysics with Dr. Mark Manley. He was my undergrad advisor, too, though this was a grad class. Way back in, 2001 or 2002. And I think we did use a book for that. I just can't remember what it was called.
All right. We have a question here from Winton Ashley. And thank you, Winton, for your $10 super chat. He says, Isaac, there's antimatter and matter, but what about neutral matter? Could it touch both without exploding? Maybe it could solve antimatter storage, being able to store it in neutralium, powder, or foil.
That's one of those ones that's probably best answered by watching our antimatter episode, but kind of the short form on that, we have a habit of saying that antimatter and matter, when they touch, explode. That is not really true. What happens is whenever you combine two things with very different setups there that are opposite, an event will take place that reshuffles everything around. One of the most likely reshuffles of all the valence and C quarks going on there is a pair of big photons, which effectively, you have a ton of it, is an explosion, same as an atomic bomb, but it doesn't have to actually produce that effect. And there are plenty of things that don't even do that with their antiparticle. Neutrons, antineutrinos and neutrinos don't really interact that we know of. Dark matter probably does not either, but problem to say. There's no real need for neutral matter in that kind of context, because it's kind of like a positive, negative, but maybe there's something like that out there and we don't know about it yet, too. Particle Zoo.
Here's a question that you're going to enjoy from Worsten. Thank you, Worsten, for your £20 super chat. Isaac, what are your thoughts on eclectic vehicles and electric vehicles and AI auto driving?
I like eclectic vehicles, too.
I know.
I like electric vehicles. I tend to think that they got pushed a little bit too hard early on when they weren't really up to snuff yet. And this made a lot of people very pessimistic on them as a result. You try to stuff something down people's throat, they are going to be permanently not fond of it. But electric vehicles are starting to kind of make that transition into generally economical. They probably can get to economy of scale, in the next decade. where they'd be genuinely competitive without subsidy. That's hard to say. Batteries is the big one on that one, too, of course. I like them as a nice combination to go with nuclear power and solar power combinations, but really that's more about getting the right batteries, getting better solar panels, and convincing people that nuclear power is good, which I think we also have some episodes coming up on. Yes, we do. Embracing Nuclear Power, August 5th episode. and a Future of Thorium episode, which is September 2nd. I have the schedule on the right. And I know we're up on the screen, we show the next month's episodes, but we usually are planned out more in advance. Like, I think the schedule right now goes to September 23rd, Spaceports. So, quite a few episodes coming up.
Jossie George wants to know about the Dyson Sphere. If we wanted to live on them, how would we obtain the atmosphere?
You can't, well, I shouldn't say you can't. You could potentially build Dyson spheres with anti-gravity technology if you had, or artificial gravity technology, but the classic Dyson shell image that people get, and that's why we so often use the term Dyson swarm instead, to just indicate a lot of artificial habitats floating around a star. There is no gravity inside a spherical shell. If you add up all the various points of gravity inside a spherical shell, you like a hollow earth, inside there, whether you're 1 foot away from the edge or in the center, there is zero gravity. So if you got an atmosphere inside there, it's going to fall into the sun, because the sun in the middle is still pointed towards you. But you will still be able to breathe, because you'll also fall in with the atmosphere to the sun. And some months later, you would land in the sun.
that sounds,
you exciting, know, yeah.
Land in the sun and burn to a crisp.
Burn to a crisp, yes, yeah.
Okay. On that lovely note, we had a clarifying question from Sam Jones on the string theory concept. Mm-hmm. He said, if string theory did turn out to be true, could the idea that gravity leaks across spatial dimensions explain dark matter?
Dark energy is usually the thing that they think of as being connected to rather than dark matter. We tend to think that dark matter is just a type of matter that is fairly non-interactive. And again, there's a lot of matter we already have who is not very interactive, neutrinos. Dark matter only has to be as non-interactive as neutrinos and just heavier, like most particles. Most particles are actually heavier than atoms that we have, most particle types, like tau neutrinos and bottom and top quarks are both heavier than whole atoms. But the leakage thing is more the dark energy concept. Gravity is insanely weaker than the other three physical forces. Electro weak, strong, nuclear, they all, you know, not as strong as each other. There's a difference of, you know, orders of magnitude between them, but gravity is a trillion, trillion, trillion times weaker. So the assumption is, and only positive, the assumption is often that it is connected to the flow of time, that gravity is only positive in the direction of time flowing forward, or that it leaks between universes, as in string theory. Those are very good theories. I don't really like to popularize them, though, because, again, there's no evidence that they're true. And I feel like when we popularize it a lot, it can get people the impression that that's been worked out, and then 10 years later, someone kills the theory, and everyone says, ah, ha, ha, you've proven this thing wrong once again. And it gives people the impression that physics is one of those fields that constantly disproves itself, when, in point of fact, I can't remember whatever having done so even once. So we'll take one more question before we go to break.
Oh, I had like four.
Oh, okay. Can we can rapid fire them and go to break.
Can we speak those in? We got quite a few coming in, so... Silver Comic, what do you consider to be some low-hanging fruit in trying to investigate the Fermi paradox that we're not currently pursuing?
Looking for atmospheric signatures, probably a high level of oxygen would be the easiest one.
Okay. Also, we have a super chat from Eric Johansson. Thank you for your donation. Would a united world government, even just a loose confederation, be beneficial for humanity to expand into space?
Probably less than people would expect. You know, neither the Soviet Union or the United States actually needed a unified government to get to the moon.
Well, and it might have discouraged them from pursuing it as rapidly.
Yeah, I could think of it as being quite useful in many ways to have a unified government, or the exact opposite, but the key is I don't expect us to ever really have one until maybe centuries down the road we colonize millions of other planets or something, in which case I like to think we could colonize space, so probably could do it without a unified government, otherwise I ain't getting it done, probably.
Lucas Spren asks, if you agree that it doesn't bode well, how many people hold on, maybe I didn't read this question. Sorry about that. I think I'm going to skip that one and move on to the last one here with Darren Jones. We are a species We as a species are just about ready to start expanding into space again. Are we on the verge of greatness or conflict?
We are always on the verge of greatness and conflict. Except for when we are completely over the edge into the, both of those things. We are always a species that kind of thrives on a bit of chaos, but that's how it works with us. I think we are always on the edge of self-destruction, and we are at the same time both incredibly vile and noble. All those wonderful things. What a great dichotomy. And on that note, let's go to break.
I was going to say, I think.
So we will be on break for a few minutes, and it's a great time to get a drink and a snack and some more questions into our moderators. For those of you who tuned into last month's live stream, where we were doing our first one at the new studio, and the audio was out for the first couple of minutes, then the camera failed, twice. Thanks for joining us again this month, and fingers crossed we are having less technical difficulties. But when the first camera failure happened, I'd been in the middle of discussing how black holes distort space-time, and I thought I'd continue and finish that while we're on break. The first thing to understand is that black holes are tiny and have no special gravity going on. Turning a star into a black hole does not result in its planets getting sucked in, or even making it dangerous to be nearby. It's regular gravity and doesn't start producing its weirder effects until you are considerably closer to it than would already have been lethal close to the old star pre-black hole. Whenever you put matter or energy in a place, it draws things towards it and makes it a bit harder to get away the nearer you pass, as it would leech your velocity, and if you increase that enough, the velocity would rise to the speed of light or higher. One key notion there, the event horizon of a black hole is that place where it reaches light speed, but it doesn't stop right after that. Go a few meters lower, and the escape velocity is now even higher. Now, folks tend to know of the event horizon and know that time slows near a black hole and eventually freezes, but this is not specifically at the event horizon, except to an external viewer, since what they would see would be you falling into that hole then freezing, rather than disappearing, as no photons bouncing off you are escaping to reach them anymore. This frozen image is going to redshift away, though, growing weaker, as an ultra-slow motion capture of the last few handful of photons to escape you as you fell, and as each microsecond passed in that last bit of time, each new set of photons has to work harder and get more redshifted as they escape, until they finally can't anymore, and each takes longer to claw its way out to the observer. So all this in terms of space-time freezing is when you see time seem to stop for the person falling in, and indeed if you left right after them right before that, so you were falling toward the black hole yourself, you'd see them longer than someone else stationary to that black hole would, because that escape velocity of the photons is just a blanket approximation for the outside galaxy. All motion is relative, and you can get photons from that person falling in longer if you're flying in behind them. And in reverse, if you're flying away from a black hole, its event horizon would be bigger to you the faster you were going. Indeed, if you're falling into one, you would never see that event horizon get reached, because it will run away from you. What we mean by event horizon is when you can no longer see events on the other side of it occurring, but when talking about black holes around the galaxy, we discuss the size of event horizon in terms of just where most folks in the galaxy would see them, or often out at an infinite distance for the sake of calculation. So your time dilation is dependent on the observer, but you can approximate that, very loosely, by calculating how fast you would have to go to reach that observer and rendezvous with them, or alternatively, to calculate the potential energy needed to reach them, convert that into kinetic energy, then into speed, and jam it into the Lorentz formula. 1 divided by the square root of 1 minus the square of the velocity as a fraction of light speed, to find out how much slower time should be going. Critically though, it's only when we start talking about building shell worlds around supermassive black holes, what we call a Birch planet, or when we contemplate building some sort of raft of computers in virtual worlds in close orbit of a black hole, that time slows any degree that would be relevant to a society. Needless to say, that's still an abridged explanation, but hopefully a bit clearer than the one given last time when the answer was on the fly with technical problems going on. And now, back to our hopefully glitch-free second half of the show. And we're back.
So you're ready for that question that we left on the break with Lucas Sprin. It says, do you agree it doesn't bode well how many people practically worship Elon Musk and doesn't question whether he is sole designer on SpaceX or not? He never said he was, but some people think he is.
In fact, that's a leading question. Elon Musk, for a lot of people, is a love or hate figure. I think very well of him, but I think of him the same way I think of like Tesla or Edison. They're good at promoting their work, and that's a very positive trait to have in a corporation that's trying to get people to invest, you know, untold billions into something that has, you know, not got a proven track record of return. So I'm very impressed with his ability to do that. I don't think he's ever tried to claim credit for anybody's work, even by omission, though. He's the front man for that organization. But the thing to keep in mind is we still have a lot of inventions, most inventions, though, done by single people. But a lot of the big projects, you know, it's always the, you know, John Smith, Joe Doe, and et al. And et al. Is like 1,000 hardworking people who just didn't make the top of that paper. And, you know, big companies like that can happen too. But I think of Elon Musk as a good guy, but just another person. I don't really get why people worship or loathe him. He's a guy who gets a lot of work done for what we do, and he employs a lot of good people.
Roger M. says, don't you think that we should focus in panspermia of life through the solar system rather than finding life in dead planets?
I mean, I might be misunderstanding that a little bit. Panspermia is the idea that life came from off-Earth I shouldn't say off-Earth specifically. The idea is that some source of life has propagated the entire universe prior to, or galaxy or regions with a common core, as opposed to space colonization of a technological nature. We did do an episode on panspermia, too, where we looked at the odds on that. But until we've actually had a chance to really dig into some of these planets, and we've never been to another planet with an actual research team yet, I think it's way too soon to be talking about the probabilities of life on any of them, you know.
Sci-Fi by Alan Crawley, thank you for your $20 super chat. He says, you do a brilliant job of presenting the science of futurism. What about the political dimensions of moving into space, and how do things like the Artemis Accords move us forward into space?
Again, we are doing that geopolitics episode with Rudyard from What If Alt Hist, shortly in July, and he'll be kind of trying to look into that too. But the thing is, you know, trying to guess who's going to win the next election term is tricky enough without trying to throw in space to that too. I think folks sometimes spend a little bit too much time trying to predict the political situation. And a lot of times it's kind of wish fulfillment. It's like with aliens, it was like, these aliens who are much more noble than us and will do these much more enlightened things, and we all done and basically realize that these aliens agree with them on everything, and that's, they're just assuming that they're enlightened because of that, or that's what enlightened ones would act like. The history of our world has been one of constant turmoil with changing political and ideological systems. I can't imagine that spreading out over a galaxy or even just a solar system would suddenly make us more homogenous. But that's my opinion.
We have a lot of government questions today. Paul Leek II wants to know, how do you feel about the saying, one man's utopia is another man's dystopia, and how it relates to unified governments and the ethics of implementation?
Oh, yeah, I think that's unambitious. One man's utopia can also be his dystopia, I should think. what a lot of us would like to see is not what others of us would like to see. It depends on what your core assumption is for how life should work out. And, you know, what is the core basis for your morality and things like that. I'd say the political questions actually be better directed at my wife, the politician, rather than me. But, I will not answer questions that would, you know, speak to basically advantage a certain political situation or position. That's not what this show's about. I have those, same as everybody else. I just, you know, we try to keep the show away from that and not pretendo neutral. I have these opinions, but rather I just try to keep my own opinions out of it too. And so be a little bit careful with some of the political questions, gents, because on ladies, I would not answer them, generally speaking. So
We have a super chat of 25. Actually, I'm not familiar with HRK from Pantagana. And she is saying, why do you think so many people use the word fold when they mean times? A fold is double, so a 1,000 fold increase is 2 to the 1,000 times, not 1,000 times.
That's actually a good question. I tend to be one of the relatively few people who uses phrases like tenfold or 1,000-fold in casual conversation, but there would be, if we were thinking of it in that context, 2 to the 10th power is 1,024, right? And 1,000-fold would be 2 to the 1,000th power, which should be something like 10 to the 33. That's what, 10 to the 133, something like that. Doesn't matter. 10 to the 333, maybe. Whichever.
You're guessing.
Yeah, I am kind of guessing at this point.
That is not.
It would be like 10 to 333. But I don't know the actual basis for that expression. It might actually mean times. That would be an etymology question I couldn't answer.
I thought it was a good question as use of the word appropriately, but it also begs the question, you know, when you use a word a certain way,
does it change the underlying
meaning from what it originally was to common usage?
A lot of time, the original meaning is not even what the original was recorded to, because it was in common usage for like a century before we got around to letting out what it meant.
Kevin Berg says, "Have you noticed the doomsday argument is moot because we are such a young race?"
No, I think the doomsday argument is a probabilistic argument. We did an episode on it way, way back, like season 1 or 2. It's like somewhere in the first 20 episodes, I think. I've always meant to actually redo the episode on that just to explain the wow that works through a little bit. But it's an example of a probabilistic argument in the Anthropic Principle, and it's one of our three big ones that we use to demonstrate the Anthropic Principle. The other two being fine-tuned universe. You know, is this universe uniquely suited to life, and the simulation hypothesis, is this universe real? But the concept there is that in science we have two principal ways, and in day-to-day life we have two principal ways that we deal with total ignorance, right? We can assume that whatever we encounter is a mediocre example, the Copernican or mediocrity principle approach, or we can assume that all seeing an object is not random, the anthro, self-oriented principle. And that would be something like, I look around, I see 10 other people wearing a jersey, and I'm wearing a jersey too. We should not assume that most people wear jerseys. We should assume that I'm seeing those people because I'm a team member of theirs who just got knocked on the head. The key about all of those, things like the doomsday principle, so a doomsday argument, sim hop, and fine-tuning is not so much the answer, is that these are examples we can use where it's impossible to get more information from a practical standpoint. And so it allows us to actually ask these questions about how the best way to ask a question in total ignorance is. And that's where that comes in. But maybe we should do the Doomsday Argument episode again, though, because it's a fun topic.
Jamar100, also thank you for your super chat. He says, I'm a big fan. My question is, when we say that a black dwarf could one day turn into iron, do we literally mean a ball of solid metal that you could walk on?
You wouldn't want to walk on it, probably.
Might burn your feet.
Well, it would be cold by then, to be fair. The iron star phase takes place so long down the road after something's gotten to be a black dwarf. You got to keep in mind, a black dwarf still has about half the mass, half a solar mass, and now it's condensed into iron. And when it gets to that point, it can start transitioning to a black hole, but just anything of that size, when it's down to an Earth size and cooled down, the gravity on that's enough to shatter you completely just from the difference in force from your feet to your head. You're getting near to the spaghettification point of a black hole at that point. So,
I just saw a chat. Somebody says, you're building a spaceship in the backyard. They must have seen my raspberry bed.
Did they? It's visible from the freeway.
Dr. Awesome, what is the unit insignia on the mug in the background? I think they're looking at your SFIA.
This
mug.
One?
Yes. Oh.
That says, if brute force isn't working, you aren't using enough of it. It's one of our merchandise cups. I think there's actually a link for them in the episode description, so you can get them on the website.
Light, thank you for your super chat. And he says, hi, Isaac. Do you think that lunar colonization could be profitable today? And if not, what are the biggest obstacles that need to be overcome first?
Other mugs. Lunar, what was it again?
Colonization.
Lunar colonization is possible today? Yeah.
Profitable today. Not profitable. Just possible, profitable. That's the key question.
Since I am not a billionaire, I tend to be careful throwing out in terms like profitable and what would be, since if I knew these like that, I presumably would be a billionaire.
Or you would not be a billionaire because you would have spent the money on it all.
That's true, yeah. I think, I don't know, could you do one now? Yes, we could absolutely do a moon base now. We could even do a moon colony now. Could we make it profitable? I don't see how it could be profitable in a classic sense of the stage. More in a sort of like early investment, you buy stock in it and a century from now it pays off really well, or you can sell it for increasingly large amounts down the road. It seems like if you're asteroid or comet mining with something that would take a century to get back, you might be able to say, hey, we can prove we have this thing. It's coming back towards Earth and arrive here a century from now and sell for $100 per unit. I'm willing to sell my share right now for $10 per unit. So that's an option, maybe. Future commodities forecasting.
Kevin Farquad says, Isaac, first time here. I love your live stream. Apologies for the interruption. I just wanted to say I'm a huge fan. Thank you so much for all of your work. I love all of your content. Again, thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, and that was a great interruption. Thank you very much.
Sanobello says, are there any ways that we could have a shape-shifting human?
Yes, for a given value of human. You know, one of the first times I heard it really put into semi-scientific terms was in Frank Herbert's sequel to the original Dune novel, Dune Messiah, with Benny Talaxu, and I can't remember what their shapeshifters are called. But they are mules. But I can't remember what they're called. Anyway, they have shapeshifters there where they have all sorts of very intensive muscle control and you know, can move their joints, things like that. Gets very copial. But probably the one... Not a very good movie, but probably a good example for this was the Terminator sequel that had Doctor Who in it as Skynet, where John Connor, because they wanted to destroy the franchise, had been turned into a machine composed of tiny little machines instead of a big robot. So he basically was walking around as a trillion little machines like cells that could assemble into a human form. And that would be a really good example of how you would do that. Probably not by having single machines that were all identical, either, any more than the body we have is. So just the idea that you could have a cohesive force between those that allowed you to rearrange them.
Sounds like this person might have been watching your panel discussion yesterday on
the IDSC.
International Space.
International Space Development Conference, yes.
So, civil engineering with Tanya Laird. Hi, Isaac. Could a black hole farming civilization last indefinitely by dumping their waste heat back into their black hole? We were just discussing waste heat. From that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of our original... For context, we missed it. The International Space Development Conference that got canceled last year... went on this year virtually, and that was the last few days going on there, and I showed up as a panelist and asked to accept the award, and this year the award I got, which is seen in the background up there, I have the camera on Sarah again. Oops.
You're on me.
I should laugh. The one back there in the corner, that's the award from them from last year. But congratulations to Phil Plate, by the way, for having won it this year. It's black holes, heat loss, and I get distracted today. I think it's because it's a Sunday. I should go out and play in the garden after this. But you could potentially dump heat down a black hole, okay. But we do not really know how the thermodynamics of black holes works. There's a tendency to assume that you can use black holes to cheat thermodynamics, when in point of fact, all we know for sure is that we can't say for sure that you can't. We haven't ruled out that black holes follow the laws of thermodynamics yet, or some close version of them. And until we do, there is a possibility you could dump heat down to one, without, you know, and then pull it back out as an entropy-free source. But I tend to be a little bit dubious about that, or using it as a stealth tech of being able to hide your civilization from it. But here's the big one. You would probably be able to find some way to dump some in. You would still have some leaking out that just got missed. And if you are a civilization that can actually do that, you got to think about the kind of civilization that you'd be trying to hide yourself from that would be a threat. If you've mastered black hole technology and heat farming like that, they better be some multi-galactic empire, or you're going to curb stomp them. So you're not really all that worried about hiding the little bits of trails, and then they could see those tiny little bits anyway. So,
okay, I think this is a follow-up question from Worsten from earlier. And thank you again for your donation, Worsten. He says, your thoughts on AI in autopilot or auto-drive in vehicles. Now, I know that you're looking forward to when I can get that to drive to Columbus. But
my usual notion is that... you know, it's not about do I trust the computer to drive better than I do, it's do I trust the computer to drive better than you do? The answer is yes.
I drive pretty good.
You drive pretty good. I will acknowledge that. But, I mean, I actually trust the computer to drive better than me because I have zoned out before. I have had, you know, in God knows how many hundreds of thousands of miles driving over 5 years of driving, I've had times where I've zoned out, almost gotten accidents, and I've gone off the road once or twice, too. You know, it's The computer's not going to get tired like that, and that's the advantage of it. And we're not going to put something like that in place until it's been really tested. You know, it's going to be safer than the average driver by an order of magnitude before we ever let it actually hit the road.
Do you think it would, like, allow you to switch back and forth? So if you're driving a short trip and you want to drive, you can. And if you're driving a long trip and you want to take a nap, that's an option?
It will be customizable to what people want to be, but the place where it's likely to leak in first is going to be on the freight side of things, where it's just straight drive slow, and the other is going to be where it catches you, you start to go off the curve. There's already getting those in place where it will auto-correct for you. That's where it leaks in. And, you know, most of us want to still have our hands on the wheels, but we like to know that if we start drifting off, you know, there's going to be that rumble strip on the side that lets us be awake. Well, in this case, we like to know the car is going to get the wheel back on the road. That's kind of where that's probably going to go for us. But, yeah, I think you absolutely want to be seeing computers more heavily used in cars. We've had autopilot on airplanes for a long time. We still have pilots. But at the same time, do we really need to have them on everything? Probably not. So they'll definitely get into there. I'd like them.
James Nagari says, why aren't people pursuing cold fusion?
Because fusion fundamentally is best done at very high temperatures. That's kind of the issue there. High pressures and temperatures where it's most easily done. If we had a good theoretical model for how you could actually achieve cold fusion, then we'd be throwing people at it left and right. And it's not just, there have been a lot of scams on cold fusion that have come out. There's also been a lot of real research done in that direction, too. There have been scams with every other type of power source. Cold fusion has a bad rap, but part of that comes from the fact that there is no known theoretical basis for you to not do it as a scam. So when someone develops a good theory that isn't scammy, then it will probably get a better reputation.
Jamal Inusa says, what are some recommended readings for someone interested in futurism at a beginner level, please?
For futurism specifically at a beginner level, I mean, you know, Ray Kurzweil, Werner Vinge, those are good places to kind of start off on some of the thoughts of it. I wouldn't say they're really, I'm not sure if there really is a beginner level of it, but those are probably the most cited ones. Anything by Nick Bostrom. You know, he's a philosopher more than a futurist, but a lot of his works on things is exactly kind of thinking where you're at for that, to kind of move in that direction. I cannot remember the name of the fellow who runs Less Wrong, Eliza Yudowski, I think maybe I'm probably mispronouncing that. A lot of the basic futuristic thoughts that you see there, Adam Sandberg, those are good ones too. But book-wise, I don't know that I'd really say there's any book I'd specifically recommend. If I write one, I'll recommend that one, though.
How about your favorite science fiction movie?
Favorite science fiction movie is always Blade Runner. The original. That's always my number one. And followed shortly by the David Lynch portion of Dune.
James Thompson Green wants to know, how about a future episode on, quote, clearing a Kessler syndrome? In other words, the worst case has happened. How short of waiting a long time could the orbit be cleared?
How short could be cleared? An hour. Flight time for a nuclear bomb to go up there and everything that's in that orbital path to be vaporized, pretty much. About an hour. If you're willing to shoot nukes off in low orbit, which it depends on how badly do you want to get off that planet. And keep in mind, you can set Kessler syndrome off on some planet that has no atmosphere or ecology on it, too. So,
Guadam Vinold says, hi, Isaac. What do you think will happen after the theory of everything? What will be the major implications, and what will be the new frontier of science and research?
I was ranting about string theory a little bit earlier. This is another thing that happens with the theory of everything. It would be neat to have a theory of everything, a grand unified theory that connects gravity up with, you know. But there is a tendency to assume that this must be true because we would like it to be true, and because we found out the strong force was connected to the weak force, and that to electromagnetism, and that electricity and magnetism were connected, so gravity must be connected, even though it has nothing at all like those on the fact that it operates in a three-dimensional universe in that inverse square way. There may be a grand unified theory, but we should not take it as a given that there is, and that's what I kind of mean when I say things like how a given theorist or, you know, group of theorists or the popular media is kind of taking a theory that has no real evidence to back it up per se and pushing it as something that almost certainly is true in the way the public absorbs it. You know, I would love to have a grand unified theory. I tend to tilt towards assuming there will be one, but don't take that as a given. If you approach it from the assumption that there is one, you could end up getting blinded to the alternative things, so they have nothing to each other, that they're right angles to each other, you know?
Nephilbutta Nation says, hi, Isaac. What do you think the first reactions to an undeniable detection of an alien civilization will be?
WTF, OMG. probably. There's a faster type in. Yeah. So.
Parceline Tao, thank you for your super chat at $5. He says, hi, great people. What's the biggest bang we can theoretically produce? Is a well-timed Penrose process on all available black holes the biggest bang?
You know, there's the idea that you could connect all the various black holes in the universe together simultaneously through whatever was allegedly theoretically connecting them and then set them off to detonate in some fashion. I think the biggest bang you could ever set off in one shot would probably be the Big Bang, although that's not really the right way to look at that explosion. I think your biggest probably are the ones we always see naturally occurring, like quasars or black hole mergers. So probably your biggest energy release one you could plausibly have happen would be two galactic core black hole mergers. You should see a lot of those happening in about the 1 quadrillion year range, I guess, is when you'd see a lot of those happening.
Michael Tape says, is it your opinion that life exists under the ice of Europa? And what might be the most expedient method of finding signs of this life?
Expedient?
Expedient. You know, like
nuclear
quick
bomb. Yeah.
To find life? Wouldn't that destroy it?
Sorry. I always try to find uses for nuclear bombs that are peaceful. We did a test. It was always a bit of a funny one. It was the day after President Obama got nominated for the Peace Prize, was also the, like, the headline article was NASA nukes moon.
That's the next question.
Yeah. But we did an impactor onto the moon to cause dust to, you know, to shoot up in the, not atmosphere, but low orbit of the moon, and then we could spectroscopically analyze that dust. You could theoretically ram something into Europa that managed to penetrate that hole 10 kilometers deep or whatever it is to get to the ice there down to the water and have the water spray up and analyze that for life forms that came up, which is a good thing to use like a mass drive or rod from God or a nuke for. But probably your best way to do it, if I was going to just throw one together, would be a large radio thermogenic RTG, a large radio thermal isotope generator, on the end of a long fiber optic cable that had good tensile strength, that you just let it melt down the ice all the way down 10 kilometers and then have sensors on the back end of that. And of course, you want to make sure that's well shielded, otherwise all your new life forms would be getting encountered by that RTG-powered probe, would be getting sterilized by that radioactive probe. But, you know, it's doable. That's how you'd melt down through the ice, I think.
Not Intimidated asks, what would the consequences be of taking mass off the moon?
I think the question that tends to come up is if we took mass off the moon in large quantities, and you have to say that'd be a lot of quantities, that it would somehow change the orbit of the Earth or the moon or things like that. And the trick to remember is that we have angular momentum, think about, for instance. If you are taking stuff off the moon, when you left the moon, you were pushing against the moon in a different direction when you did that. So, you know, like when you add mass to the moon, you were already... You don't slow the orbit of a planet or a moon down by adding mass to it in general, because the stuff you added to it was already going at that speed when you injected it. But you could, if you were willing to extract the equivalent of the entire Earth crust from the moon, that could have a significant impact on the overall mass distribution of the Earth-Moon system to cause some orbital changes. But you'd have to run through the calculations on them, and they'd be very specific to each case.
Kevin Dunn says, Isaac, when do you think we will get to building a giant telescope on the far side of the moon?
That would be something I would hope to see this century, especially when those big Zena telescopes, just because I think that's cool to have one that's made out of liquid metal. That should be, I'd say we probably have probes or telescopes, decent-sized ones, on the dark side of the moon, far side of the moon, obviously as dark in terms of noise. Probably in the next couple of decades, to be honest. It's so advantageous to land one there, and if you put Hubble up, you can put Hubble up and put it on the side of the moon, is the idea.
Michael Linksquinsky said, thank you for your $20 super chat, and he says, sup, man, keep up the good work, loving the show.
Will do, man. Thank you.
KW Matterhorn, hey, Isaac, what are your thoughts on Lancaster Labs' quench gun? They say they could eventually scale payload to orbit cost down to $50 a kilo.
That would be awesome if they pulled it off. You know, we have a lot of things that could potentially drop it down to under $100 a kilo. I like Lostrum loops as my preferred one for that, along with orbital rings, as everyone knows, but those are much further down the road. Fuel is not really the big cost in that stuff. It's the reusability angle and a lot of the launch costs, and I think that's hard to really calculate because a lot of that relies on economy of scale, too.
Okay,
I think we got time for a few more questions, then we've caught quits.
All right. Valardarg, excuse me if I mispronounce that one, Valardarg says, does Isaac see a future where these unprovable or disprovable theories like multiverse, simulation, etc. turn into full-blown science-centric religions?
Yes.
Well, that was easy. Next question.
I mean, that could happen very easily.
Did you want to expound on that?
You know, physics kind of broke off of math toward the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century because it was kind of the idea on the one hand that you wanted to be getting a lot more actual experimental proof of ideas than just what worked on paper. At the same time, there was an awful lot of, you know, mysticism and woo-hoo on the physicists of the late 19th century, too. And so that's, you know, you look at that period in time, had a lot of that, too, like Egyptology especially took off in that period. There was a lot of tendency of various scientific theories to quantum mysticism is its whole religion already. So, yes.
The videographer experience says, Isaac, do you think humanity will make it, become multi-planetary or multi-habitat in time to survive potentially a billion years or so?
A billion years is a very long time to really have anything that we might qualify as humanity still kicking around at that point. I would think that if we were still around anything that was really recognizably us, that it would probably be not a great sign for us either because it would be a bit stagnant. But at the same time, yeah, I think we will. You know, it kind of though is kind of like asking, you know, would an amoeba last that long? I think we'd be around still in some fashion, or something that we'd made that could call itself a child of ours would be around.
Q9073 says, what do you think of the physics of multiple time dimensions? I can't seem to find much on the topic, and I feel like it might be another form of multiverse travel if they exist.
And I leaked that script or something. We've had so many people mentioning things in the script I just finished writing like last week.
What day is that one coming out again?
That one's coming out on August 26th, Edge of the Universe.
Ooh, on the edge of their seats for the summer.
Yeah. Multiple time dimensions is every bit as an option, same as multiple physical dimensions. A lot of other ones, too. I mean, sometimes the basis for things like, you know, magnetism and electricism is to assume there's another dimension that they operate in, and that's the cause of them. There's an up-down that's compactified. You know, it's there's room for other dimensions outside space and time, and there's room for multiple time dimensions, too.
Okay. Another question here from Albert Jackinson. What form do you think the internet and social media will take in the future, especially with technologies such as BCIs and VR?
Predicting the internet in that context is really hard. The internet's main purpose is to transmit information around, and that's why it's mostly used for showing cats and their love of cheeseburgers. and, you know, I think with BCIs, it gets a lot easier to do a lot of stuff smoothly. Like, when I was a kid, everything was about how there was going to be video telephones sometime soon. Video telephones and the long distance rates would go down a bit, too. For those of you who remember when there was such a thing as long distance phone calls and collect calls. But then video phone calls really didn't take off in favor of text messaging instead, an example of how you don't always want more bandwidth. But I think that you probably would actually start seeing a lot more of that, like, seamless, you know, communication where if you were, like, talking to someone, it felt like they were literally in the same room with them, possibly even emulated in augmented reality. I think that's probably one of the areas that would go. Everything else is so hard to predict, though.
All right. Here's the last question for today to end on a fun note. If Jeff Bezos' mystery passenger decides to give their ticket to you, would you go?
No.
I was going to say, is this the mystery passenger offering it? And how do they know you're not the mystery passenger already?
I am a very cautious person, and I am not terribly fond of flying. I would love to see space one day when it was already so mundane that it was like going to Disney World. I would put it that way. I encourage other people to go, but I myself would not.
If it was guaranteed to get back, I might take your ticket for you.
Well, you'd be welcome to take it. insurance policy.
Hey!
I did see one from France Cadet at the end, too, before we finished out. What is the right way to imagine the Big Bang? As I was just saying, I feel like I like that script. That is another one of the ones on the Edge of the Universe we'll be discussing for that. And from Wariston asking, when you're trying to go to sleep, what you wonder about lately? Usually I'm listening to an audiobook on a little headset when I go to sleep, and of late I've been listening to Caiaphas Kane, Hero of the Imperium, from the Warhammer 40K novel. So That's what I've been listening to of late and what I was thinking about when I went to bed. I guess we'll go ahead and sign off there for the day. Thank you everyone for joining us, and what a surprisingly glitch-free day it's been. I hope you all enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and have a good one. We'll see
you. And thank you to everybody for their super chats. We had a lot of super chats today. We really appreciate it.
Yes, my wife is the courteous one. Thank you everybody for your support of the channel, and we will see you on Thursday. So that will wrap us up for the day. I want to thank everyone for joining us, and again, if we didn't get to your question, feel free to post it as a comment below, and I'll try to get to it this evening. Also, you can continue the conversation at any of the forums on Facebook, Reddit, Discord, or our website, isaacartho.net. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you Thursday.